with the Muslims in the end times. And I don't know. I know what is happening right now. I know that the New Agers and the postmodernists, okay, and I believe, you know, there's a lot of people that think, you know, postmodernism is where it's at. Let me tell you something. Postmodernism is not really a worldview. It's an anti-worldview. It demolishes everything else, but then it leaves nothing else standing. So, I mean, you got to come up with something positive, some positive beliefs, if you're really going to capture people's hearts. And so I think that postmodernism is going to eventually go neo-pagan. I don't think they're going to call it the New Age movement because there's too many embarrassments there already. But I think it's going to be, maybe they'll call it neo-spirituality or whatever. But I think it's going to give it, and even postmodernists are very open to bringing back the ancient myths. And they don't believe they're true. But if you start flirting with the ancient myths, you're inviting demons to your household. So I think we're going to see postmodernists go New Age. In the United Nations, I mean, it is New Age to the max. I mean, even their meditation room, the United Nations chaplain, Robert Mueller, former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, is called the father of global education, and he's a New Ager to the max. So I think in the end, postmodernism is going to go the route of the New Age movement. And even Stanley Grenz, who I don't agree with on a lot of his stuff, but Stanley Grenz acknowledged at a conference I attended that the biggest, it's like he's got postmodernists here and Christians trying to lead them to Christ, and the biggest competitor that Christians have are the New Agers with the doctrine that man is God. That is the... that he thinks there's an open door to postmodernists, but there's also an open door to Christianity for postmodernists, but there's also an open door to the New Age movement, and I just think that he should put a little bit more emphasis on that, and Stanley Grenz has too high of a view of postmodernism. He's sure it was right to correct the ugly aspects of modernism, but postmodernism brings with itself a whole lot of ugly aspects as well. And by the way, as far as New Age pantheism with the this-worldly emphasis, there's only one major example of a culture being saturated with that thought in the 20th century, and that was Nazi Germany. Anybody who says the Nazis were Christians, they don't know what they're talking about, but anyone who says the Nazis were Nietzschean atheists, no, that's a little bit of window dressing there. Pay a little lip service to Nietzsche, get some intellectual icing on the cake, make it look real good, but they were neo-pagans, and they were this-worldly. You know, the Aryan race is divine, non-Aryans are subhuman. We don't want the non-Aryans to pollute the pure Aryan genetic code, and we want to usher in the next stage in the human evolution of the Aryan race, and so therefore we need to weed out the subhumans. And now the New Age movement, you know, and it amazes me that the Nazis of today, the neo-pagans of today, what's the first thing out of their mouth when they talk about Christians? They refer to us as Nazis. And if you're going to misdiagnose the Holocaust, you're in jeopardy of repeating it. And so I don't know what order, but basically Christians, Muslims, and Jews, traditional Christians, Muslims, and Jews, we are the target of the New Agers and the postmodernists. Now, at this particular time, it seems like, you know, let's slam the Christians in the media, let's slam them, you know, keep them out of the public schools, keep them out of the universities and, you know, teaching positions and all. Let's slam them that way. But it seems like there's almost a strategy, if you will, at the very least a demonic strategy, to back Islamic irrational demands to wipe out Israel. Okay, so in other words, it seems that Islamic fundamentalism is a helpful tool for the agenda of the New Agers and the postmodernists that hold key positions throughout the world. Now, it may be that the New Agers are thinking, okay, once we wipe out the Jews or practically wipe them out, then we can turn on the Christians, and then after that we can get to the Muslims. Now, if that is the strategy, they'll never get to the Muslims, because as they're trying to wipe out the Jews and the Christians, one Jew returns who the New Agers, you know, should not lock horns with. His name is Jesus. You know, but whatever the case, you know, if we are in the last days, I just can't see traditional Muslims accepting the mark of the beast either. So, you know, they might be, that might be our mission field in the last days. But whatever the case, it's all theists are targets of this worldly pantheism, like New Age pantheism. And okay, we already talked about postmodernism. You know, we'll spend some time on that later on in the course, where it's the individual is the product of their community. The community is defined by its narrative, and there is no meta-narrative, no absolute truth, no narrative that can judge. Stand and judge and say, well, that narrative, that story is false, that story is true, or whatever. So, I mean, language, instead of language representing truth, or somebody claiming to argue for truth, language is just a power game, a power play. And so, by the way, and this is why Nietzsche is called a postmodernist. When reason and truth are thrown out the window, Nietzsche says all that is left is what? The will to power. And that's what postmodernism is all about. Because, I mean, when they say the emperor has no clothes, they also expose themselves. If language is a power play, it's just someone trying to force their meta-narrative down someone else's throat. Someone trying to force their views, overpower and control and manipulate others. If that's what language is, well, what is the language of the postmodernist when they proclaim their postmodern views? It's nothing but a power play itself. By the way, political correctness is one of the babies of postmodernism. And that's why, you know, the political correct ideology, if there's a politically correct politician, if his views are called into question, 9 out of 10 times he doesn't rationally argue for his position, but instead he goes on a tirade against, he attacks the person, because he did not arrive at his views through reason. He arrived at his views through his will, his emotions, and his community. He defends his positions in that manner as well. Let me just end this segment. We'll take a little 10-minute break here with a quote from Sire on page 198, where he talks about the strength of theism. That's kind of the theme of this course. After going through all these different worldviews and all, but some of them he doesn't even touch on, that I want to touch on, because he just goes at it from the historical approach. I want to do it, go at it both from the logical and the historical approach. But he says, where then are we today? In terms of possible worldviews, our options are numerous, but as we have seen, limited. Of those we have investigated, all but theism were found to have serious flaws. If our argument has been correct, none of them, theism, naturalism, existentialism, Eastern pantheistic monism, or New Age philosophy, nor the postmodern perspective, can adequately account for the possibility of genuine knowledge, the facticity of the external universe, or the existence of ethical distinctions. Each in its own way ends in some form of nihilism. Okay? So what he's based, and Gordon Clark, I wish I brought that his Thales to Dewey, his one volume, History of Philosophy work. And he says the same thing, that you either accept the word from God or you end up with nihilism. And he says, so in the end, your choice is either Nietzsche's eternal merry-go-round, suicide, or acknowledge the personal God exists and that he has given us the words. As Francis Schaeffer said in two of the titles of his books, The God Who Is There, He Is There, but in another one of his books, He Is There, But He Is Not Silent. God exists and he has spoken. And to reject Christian theism, in the end, you end up with nihilism. Why don't we take a 10-minute break, and then we'll go right from 8 to 9. If you look at, you don't have the book, but if you were looking at page 198, he talks about the serious flaws for all the worldviews except theism that they can't adequately account for the possibility of genuine knowledge. So basically, there's no basis for real knowledge. Okay? They can't explain how man knows. That's a pretty big problem if you're trying to convince people that you know your worldview is true. So it provides no basis for genuine knowledge. It can't explain the reality of the universe, the external world, or ethical distinctions. So it can't account for morality. It can't account for the physical universe. They can't account for the physical universe. And they can't account for real knowledge. So in those three areas, knowledge, providing adequate explanation for the physical universe, and for real morality, for absolute moral laws, only theism provides an adequate explanation, an adequate basis for those. So in the area of knowledge, the physical world, and morality, he says theism, just on those three points alone, shows itself to be far superior to any of the other worldviews. Okay, what I want to do now is take a quick look at Christian theism. This again is goes right back to Sayer's work on pages 23 to 38, a chapter on Christian theism, and he talks about these eight different concepts and how Christian theism tries to explain them: God, creation, man, human knowledge, sin and salvation, man's destiny, life after death, morality, and history. Now, if you look at the seven questions that we ask, that's all he's doing. He's taking the seven questions, but he just broke down a human being with the sin and salvation. He added, inserted an extra category. But he's just basically dealing with the seven questions. And so he applies these seven questions to the different worldviews. I think he does a dynamite job with that. I don't follow this across the board, but I do apply it to Christian theism, and then after that, I just start discussing the others, and it's contained in there, and I list the seven questions because I think it's a helpful grid. But it's just not something that I'm going to dogmatically follow throughout this course. I mean,
why is that?
And that's just what I was going to say. Why is that? Because if you're going to write a 250-page book or a 200-page book, you can do that justice. To give 24 hours worth of lectures. Do we even have that? We have 3 hours times 6 weeks, so we have 18, and that's assuming we don't. So in 18 hours, it's just not something you can do justice. But I've taught the same course, you know, in 40 or 50 lectures, and you still can't do it justice. So it's one of those deals where even if I were trying to teach a textbook, I wouldn't have the time to do Sire's work justice there. But I like a lot of stuff he does, so I, especially in the beginning, I throw out a lot of his ideas and stuff, and in the way he has them, he presents them. But then later on, I like to do, you know, put my own touches on things. Hopefully we'll get through Christian theism, and then we'll begin to defend theism. Which is provide evidence for God's existence. I use a cumulative case, and if we can get through those two things tonight, I'll be a happy camper. On this, for God, you need to write these words down, that God is infinite. In the Christian worldview, God is infinite, tri-personal, tri-personal. In other words, he's three persons. God is infinite. He's not just personal. Now, in Islam and Judaism, he's personal, but he's not tri-personal. Christianity, God is tri-personal. God is infinite, tri-personal, transcendent, and immanent. He's both separate from the universe. You know, he created the universe. He's separate from it. He's beyond the universe. But he's also involved with the universe, so he's immanent. He's omniscient, which is all-knowing. He's sovereign, means he's in control. That's why he's in control. He's all-powerful, omnipotent. And he's good. I mean, the list could go on. I mean, you just... Was J.I. Packer's work, Knowing God?
Yeah.
You just throw in there all of God's attributes that we can figure out from the scriptures. And but God is infinite, meaning he's unlimited. He's tri-personal, transcendent, and immanent. He's omniscient, all-knowing. He's all-powerful. He's sovereign. He's good. You could add, he's loving, he's omnipresent, everywhere present. You know, this goes on and on. by the way, it's impossible to be infinite without being omnipresent and without being omniscient and omnipotent. If you're unlimited, then to be unlimited, it's impossible to be limited by anything else. You would, by definition, also have to be all-powerful. You would have to be all-knowing. You're not limited by not knowing something. You're unlimited in knowledge. You're unlimited in power. But you would also, you could also would have to be omnipresent, because you're not limited by space. And I think for creation, Sire states that God created the universe out of nothing. It's ex nihilo rather than ex deo, out of God. God didn't create the world out of himself. We're not an emanation from God, okay? Something that flows from God. God created the universe out of nothing. We're not an extension of God. So God created the universe out of nothing. And he says this: God created the universe out of nothing, and yet the universe operates with a uniformity of cause and effect. You don't have to write this down if you don't want. Operates with a uniformity of cause and effect in an open system. Basically, what he's saying is the universe is orderly, but it's open to intervention by God. It's orderly. There's a uniformity of cause and effect. If I pick up a pen and drop it, we all expect it to fall, because that's what the law of gravity demands. The universe is orderly. I mean, can you imagine if the law of gravity just didn't work at times? You know, it didn't always work. I mean, you'd grab, you know, like this with your cup of hot coffee from McDonald's, and you'd get ready to drink it, and the hot steaming coffee would fall up in your face. I mean, in a world where the law of gravity doesn't work in a uniform way, you can't even drink a cup of coffee without putting your life on the line.
So, how would you define that, like,
interval? Okay, and this is just it. So there is a uniform way that the world works, kind of a general way that the world works, a natural way that the world works, but it's an open system. God can supernaturally intervene. So in other words, since God is the author of the laws of nature, he can suspend the laws of nature when he so chooses. So I would define a miracle as a suspension of the laws of nature rather than a violation of the laws of nature. At the same time, I would define it that way for philosophical discussion, because the Bible does refer to certain events as miracles, and there were no laws of nature that were superseded sometimes. Jonah, I mean, there's no... Yeah, I mean, and God, but it's called the sign of Jonah. It's one of the words for miracle. And yet, do storms happen? Yeah, storms happen. Storms on the sea. Do large fish swallow human beings? Yes, they do. 20th century, there was a guy fell overboard in a horrible storm. Couple days later, they harpooned, I believe it was a whale shark, were cutting it open, and they found the guy unconscious on the inside, still alive. And his skin was bleached totally white. He lost all hair, even his eyebrows and the hair on his head, and any all the hair on his body was bleached totally white. So for the rest of his life, he told his story as a sideshow act in a carnival. But so you can imagine Jonah being 3 days in the belly of a fish, what kind of a first impression he made in Nineveh. But and our large fish known, if they swallow a large, but I think it's like seven different compartments within the stomach They have several stomachs, if I remember. Well, sir, seven different air compartments where human beings could live. There's enough air to live off of. And when they get something stuck in their throats, they do swim towards the shore and for some reason then vomit it on the shore. So there's no miracle in the sense of suspending of natural laws that occur. Now, what was miraculous was the timing. So in other words, when God uses natural causes, God can use natural causes and still bring about a miracle. So sometimes the Christian philosophical definitions of a miracle are a little bit too small. There's more than just suspending. I guess a biblical miracle would be defined as God either suspending the laws of nature to catch our attention and to teach some truth, or using the laws of nature in such a unique way so as to catch our attention. You know, such as, you know, I find out I'm in debt, I need $5,000, me and the missus pray for $5,000, next day a check shows up in the mail for $5,000. The laws of nature weren't suspended, but, you know, 50 atheists could beat me with sticks. They're not going to be able to convince me that wasn't a miracle. So, but basically the idea that things, you know, and by the way, if you don't have this uniformity of cause and effect, then you're never going to be able to recognize a miracle when it happens anyway. I mean, if the law of gravity doesn't almost always work, then when the law of gravity, when God supersedes the law of gravity, no one would know. Okay, so in other words, the miracle, you know, some people say, well, I would only believe that Jesus rose from the dead if every corpse rose from the dead. Well, if every corpse rose from the dead, what kind of a sign would that be to us by raising Jesus from the dead? So you have to have a background of natural events before a supernatural event is going to catch anybody's attention. So basically, natural laws are the ways. The natural laws are the way God normally does things in this world, and miracles are the unique ways that God does things when He wants to really catch our attention. And that's why some of these hyper-Pentecostal miracles and New Age miracles, sometimes there's either no message or an anti-biblical message. Well, then you know it's not from God, no matter how spectacular it is. Human beings are created in God's image. Created in God's image and thus possess certain traits, and he lists these traits. He's good here, because most Christian apologists are still, myself included, are still targeting the modernistic mindset. Sire, I think he's got a PhD in literature, which is the big thing for postmodernists, by the way. When Christian theology reigns supreme in Western culture, a doctorate of theology degree was number one degree. When modernism reigns supreme, a PhD in some natural science or in philosophy was the big deal. But now with postmodernism, they're throwing reason out the window, everything's a narrative, PhD in literature, everybody's oohing and on. But whatever the case, and by the way, I'll tell you, just to see how postmodern our society is getting, if you want to understand how our culture thinks, do you think you would learn that by reading theology textbooks? Or do you think you'd get a better handle on how our culture thinks by watching some of the latest and most popular films? Okay, so the narrative. Basically what I'm saying is, it's not he who controls the theology department who wins. It's he who controls Hollywood. Okay? And so, you know, would I be real happy to find out half the people in this room become theology professors or philosophy professors? And yeah, that would thrill me. But to find out that the other half would become Hollywood producers or lawyers or politicians or, you know, somebody gets down and dirty, gets out there with real people and doesn't spend all their time with philosophers and theologians, that'd make me even happier. And Alistair McGrath is calling for that. I think Schaefer was that type of guy. Schaefer was not really an academic philosopher, Francis Schaefer. But we need the thought of the academic philosophers to trickle on down to creative thinkers who will then have a trickle on down to the artist and the musician. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre, French existentialist, says there is no God, therefore there's no meaning in life. There's no truth. We need meaing in life, so we take a leap of by an act of the will, we take a leap of blind faith in the non-rational realm to actualize ourselves. You know, okay? The average guy can't keep. You know, and Sartre doesn't say it like that. He takes like three books before you figure out, oh, that's what he means. And you know, you got guys with doctorate degrees reading them and can't make heads or tails of the guy. Okay? So it takes a Harvard professor, Timothy Leary, say, oh, I understand what he's saying. But you know, Jean-Paul, it's so hard to just do that by an act of the will. Why don't we artificially induce it through LSD trips? So then he starts proclaiming in his works his own watered-down, more simplistic, more artificial type of existentialism than Sartre. So then four guys from Liverpool, England, start reading this Harvard professor's work, and they say, hey, he's onto something there. And so they take their songs and they write Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, LSD, you know, the Beatles, the Fab Four. And so, I mean, if it gets to the artist, okay, then it transformed the culture. It's sad, but that's reality. You know, does it bother me that I have like 12 years of education and I have like little to no impact on my world, and some guy who calls himself Eminem is capturing an entire generation? Does that bother you? Bet that bothers me. But it's reality. And so while it's reality, you know, I'm hoping that someday the future Christian Eminem, you know, it's going to be, you know, one of my students and stuff. So, whatever the case, being created in God's image, we possess personality. Okay? I am a person. A rock is not. We possess personality, self-transcendence. Self-transcendence means that you can transcend yourself. The three members of the Trinity, you know, and so basically, you know, they could relate to one another. And here we can transcend ourselves and find out about the world in which we live and find out about others. Intelligence. You know, I'll be honest, if intelligence was caused by non-intelligence, I don't see how it's intelligence. You know, it's not what Sire's terminology, but what he means is by transcending the self, that we can get outside of, we can know more than just the self. Like, you know, Socrates said, know thyself. We can do more than just know ourselves. We can get beyond ourselves and know others.
So you have interpersonal relationships.
Well, yeah, now he deals with that specifically with social capacity. So that's part of self-transcendence. But with us, since there is a creation, it also means, you know, knowing the trees, knowing the rocks, knowing basically having knowledge of and being able to relate with things outside of ourselves.
So recognizing an environment.
And see, now with God, in God's self-transcendence, this is why it's tough. God's self-transcendence and God's social capacity, in my thinking, are synonymous. Because all God had in his environment was Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So social capacity and self-transcendence are one and the same. With us, there is a distinction. Because knowing my grandson Nathan is a different kind of knowing than knowing a rock. There's a distinction between the two. So we possess personality, self-transcendence, intelligence, morality. You know, we are moral beings. Social capacity. And creativity. Now, of course, we really can't create things out of nothing, but being created in God's image, we can take what God has created and we can come up with some pretty creative ideas and design old things in new ways.
Would you categorize these, I guess, creation of man into like general revelation versus like specific revelation? How he's chosen to reveal himself to us
There's definitely natural or general revelation, God revealing himself through nature, and there's supernatural or special revelation, God revealing himself through miracles, whether they be through angels or through Christ himself or through the Bible. But a lot of these, all he's saying there is that in the Christian worldview, man is created in God's image, and therefore we have these characteristics. Okay? Now, what he's getting at in the book is that atheism, pantheism, all these other worldviews, they really don't have. Especially, you know, once you step outside of theism, there really is no explanation for the personality of man.
If there's the law of conscience, for example, there has to be a law given.
And that would be like the moral argument for God's existence. But what he's saying is, in the Christian worldview, this explains why man is this way. Now, when you look at the other worldviews, what he's going to show is that atheism doesn't explain the personality of man. It doesn't explain self-transcendence, intelligence, morality, you know, right on down the line. This would be part of God's natural revelation, in that we could look at creation or some aspect of creation, in this case, man himself. We could look at ourselves and see God's design, learn about God from looking at ourselves. The thing is, though, too, is that mankind is such an expert at perverting God's revelation in nature that God had to write a book. You know, every nation had their own false god, and so God said, hey, enough is enough. Let me get this polytheist pagan Abraham, pull this guy over, reveal myself in a supernatural way to him, wake him up, let him see that, oh, okay, there's only one true God, and then I'll identify myself as the God of Israel. And, it's like God, in ancient times, the pagans thought, well, God's in relation to land, okay? When you go from one town to another town, find out who the god of that town is and offer a sacrifice to him so he doesn't lambast you while you're there, okay? And if your town gets conquered by another town, okay, that either means that your god is real, the god of your town is real ticked off at you, or the god of the other town is a more powerful god than the god of your town. So God was tied in with land, okay? So God comes on the scene, and God wants to relate to the people, but he's got to relate to them in their terms. So God says, okay, I'll relate to land, and that land, the promised land, and I'll relate to people, the Jewish people. Okay? And then 2,000 years after Abraham, Jesus is talking to a Samaritan woman. And she says, well, should we worship on this mountain over here in Samaria? Or do we got to go to the temple in Jerusalem to worship God? And Jesus said, a time is coming and now is, when you'll neither worship God, you won't have to worship God in Samaria on this mountain, or in the temple in Jerusalem, for God is spirit. And those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. So God is basically saying that land aspect is not essential. I can relate directly to people. Now, keep in mind, I'm not saying that God's through with the promised land. Because there are Christians that are saying that, you know, the church has replaced Israel and blah, blah, blah. And that it's
just a religion of
Christians. Yeah, yeah. And that's a really, really dangerous view.
There's other churches that are saying that too.
Yeah, sometimes it goes in the name of dominion theology, sometimes Reconstructionism, sometimes theonomy, you know, bringing back God's law and stuff like that, but and replacement theology, the church has replaced Israel. But either way, it's you know, God still does. God has a plan, and He's going to achieve His goals. And part of that goal is that all Israel will acknowledge Him as their Savior and Messiah and be saved in the last days. And then Jesus Christ is going to reign not only as King of Israel, but King over the whole earth. And then after He reigns on earth, He'll reign over the entire universe for all eternity. But I'm going to simplify these because they're taking a little bit too long. Number four, let me just read it to you. Human beings can know both the world around them and God Himself because God has built into them the capacity to do so and because He has taken an active role in communicating with them. Basically, that we can know the world and God. We can know the world and God because God has revealed the world and Himself to us. It's not like that. It's like, I'm more Augustinian than I am Thomistic. I favor Augustine and his theory of knowledge rather than Aquinas and his. Aquinas believed that we start life as a blank slate, and knowledge is in the everything in the mind was first in the senses, except the mind itself. So he believed that. Aquinas believed that we got our knowledge of equality from looking at two things of equal size, maybe, okay? And that's where we got the idea of equality. I agree with Augustine. See, Aquinas was Aristotelian, got it from Aristotle. Empirical knowledge starts in the five senses. That's Aquinas. Augustine was more rational. He was Platonic. The knowledge starts with the universals. And so basically what I'm getting at is that it seems more likely to me that seeing two things of equal size trigger in our minds the innate knowledge that is already there of the concept of equality. Okay? That we don't get these rational... You know, the way Gordon Clark put it when speaking about Aquinas, you'll never get moral values from a mound of dirt. But if Aquinas and Aristotle are right, that's exactly what happens. Now, the Bible says that God in Romans 2, 14 and 15, God's laws are written on our heart. That sounds like innate knowledge, though it might not be, it's probably not conscious knowledge, but through sense experience, it triggers some of this rational innate data that is there, that was placed by God on our hearts, part of our being created in His image. So, in Augustine's way of thinking, we are as dependent upon God for our knowledge of this chair as we are for our knowledge of salvation. Okay? And it's not that, you know, with Aquinas acknowledges both natural revelation and supernatural revelation, but he focuses on the distinction between the natural and the supernatural.